Lecture 17, Bandura's Self-Efficacy Theory.
Hello. In the last lecture, we discussed Albert Bandura's social learning theory and his conceptual contributions of expectancies and vicarious reinforcement and how they drove learning, and also the research he did regarding observational learning. In this lecture, we're going to continue to discuss Bandura's work. We're going to discuss a related theory, self-efficacy theory, which takes the cognitive process of one's beliefs and expectations even a little further. We'll also discuss other related theories of self-efficacy to gain a fuller view of how this important concept fits into human nature. And then we're going to conclude with an evaluation of Bandura's theory. In the 1980s, Albert Bandura presented this second theory called self-efficacy theory. It's connected and I think complementary to his social learning theory. This theory had a substantial influence not only on researchers in child development, but particularly on researchers of adult development and aging as well. It's valuable across all ages, is not tied to any particular age. In this theory, Bandura became even more focused on internal cognitive processes in explaining learning and development. And by doing this, he further distanced himself from the classic learning theorists. Bandura is still a learning theorist, but he doesn't fit that classic mold. Now, what is self-efficacy? Self-efficacy can be defined as the belief that one has that that person can cause an effect on one's environment. The belief or the extent that a person believes that she or he is effective, that has an influence, and that's why it's called efficacy. A person's self-efficacy, in effect, is the way that a person perceives his own abilities and competence in dealing with various problems and challenges. A person can perceive his abilities in a particular domain to be very high and another domain to be very low. I can know that I am really good at skiing and really lousy at tennis. And so how a person sees his abilities will determine to which source he attributes success and failures. If he sees his abilities or his successes as coming from his own abilities, and if he sees his failures coming from his own abilities, he may see himself as not being very good. If he sees them coming from some other situation, and it's not his fault, then he'll still have maybe a high self-efficacy. So these attributions of success and failure and the beliefs that we have about our level of efficacy and how we can accomplish things will determine what kinds of tasks we'll try and what challenges we'll take on and what kinds of tasks or challenges we'll shy away from. So let me give you an example. If you are a man and you happen to believe that you have a high level of social skill, and you're extremely appealing to women, and you have a social skill in getting along with women, you might be more likely to approach women socially and with confidence and be rather assertive and outgoing in your initial social interactions with them. On the other hand, if you believe that your level of social skill and your appeal to the opposite sex is really quite low, then you're likely to be reluctant in approaching women socially, and you'll be sort of shy and non-assertive in your reactions and interactions with them. Now, we're likely, as I mentioned, to have different levels of self-efficacy for different skill domains. I mentioned skiing, tennis. We could talk about social interactions as an area of skill. We can talk about mathematics and music and so on. However, overall, we may develop a general level or sense of high self-efficacy based on the various experiences we've had, or we may overall develop some kind of low level of self-efficacy or something in between. And so Bandura discussed an important concept to try to explain this self-efficacy and how it influences development and our learning. And he explained another concept that's intimately related to self-efficacy. This is the concept that he called reciprocal determinism. The idea of reciprocal determinism is that a person's skills and developmental level are not only determined by the environment and by others in the environment, but also that a person creates or determines her own environment by making modifications to it. So it's reciprocal, and it's determined reciprocally, because not only does the environment influence you in how you develop and the skills that you develop, but in turn, you select the environment that you place yourself in. You change your environment, in effect. You only allow certain areas or certain things in the environment to affect you and not other things. This is important because it gets away from that purely reactive, passive view of humans, that the environment is out there doing things to you and molding you. You see, it goes both ways. It's an interaction. And whenever we think of the environment having an influence on us, as learning theory did, you can also think, yes, but we change our environment. We create the environment and allow it to have this influence on us. If you believe that you're going to fail at a certain task or in a certain social situation, what are you going to do? You're likely going to avoid that task and that social situation. If you think you're going to be successful at a particular task, you're likely to seek out that task and that social situation. This isn't always true, but I've generally observed that people really like what they're good at. And they keep doing the things they're good at. They don't tend to like what they're bad at, and they tend to avoid doing those kinds of tasks and being in those kinds of situations. So as you select a specific environment, then the tasks in turn will have an influence and help you to learn and develop. And you gain more experience in some areas than in other areas. You're likely to pick the environments that you already feel somewhat comfortable and competent in. Some people have a word for this. They call it niche picking. Isn't that clever? Okay, niche picking is you pick your niche, the one that you're comfortable in. So whenever you say, it's not my fault, I was forced into these situations in my environment, my friends did this to me. Remember, in this kind of reciprocal determinism, we also pick the environment and the niches. Now, this process of reciprocal determinism is greatly influenced by our sense of self-efficacy. Our sense of self-efficacy will increase or decrease in particular areas depending on this, the influences we have and the experiences we have from reciprocal determinism, but our sense of self-efficacy will determine what we pick. So this chaining of events creates what's called self-fulfilling prophecies. You may have heard that term before. The idea is whatever we believe will happen is then validated subsequently because we brought about the situations that bring these beliefs and these predictions into fulfillment. So, for example, if that person I told you about has this high sense of self-efficacy about his social skills and his appeal to the opposite sex, he'll place himself in situations where he gains a lot of practice at these skills. And he'll act as though these attributes are already present. And it's highly likely that he'll become the kind of person he already believes he was. And of course, this can work for people having negative self-efficacy and believing they're not good at something. Let me tell you about a piece of research that just recently came out that's quite interesting. This recent research showed that women, by the way, first, this was based on a view that women in general, we realize there's many exceptions, but women in general do worse than men on math tests. And the research showed that women do worse than men on math tests, but only when they are first told that the test assesses gender differences in math abilities. If you don't tell the people taking the test that this is what it's all about, they don't differ from men in how well they do on the test. But you see, if you tell them what it's about, that we're going to look for gender differences in these math abilities, I believe their beliefs about their self-efficacy cause this self-fulfilling prophecy. They lose their confidence. They think they're going to do worse. Voila, they do worse. Now, how does this sense of self-efficacy develop? Bandura believed that there are four primary sources of information or input that come into us that act as the mechanisms to either increase or decrease our sense of self-efficacy. First, and perhaps this is the most important, our own personal successes and failures change our self-efficacy through this process of reciprocal determinism that I've already talked about. In a sense, nothing succeeds like success. For example, if we constantly get high grades on a math exam, we come to believe that we have high math skills and we can take math exams with confidence. Now, the second mechanism or source is through observational learning, and we talked about that last time. In other words, we gain vicarious reinforcement. We see the successes and failures of other people whom we perceive to be similar to ourselves. And we think that these attributes that they have must also apply to ourselves. For example, if we see a person we identify as being successful at public speaking, we may think, I'm really a lot like that person, so I must have that same ability because we're a lot alike and we're likely to imitate that person. So we see others as being, we talked about seeing others and seeing them being rewarded or punished as vicarious reinforcement. We also see others and see what they're good at and what they're bad at. And if we identify or see the similarities, we pick up these same things. The third source is what others say about us. What others say influences how we think about ourselves. That seems obvious. If they say something good about us, we tend to be influenced by it, or something bad about us. And also, it depends on whether they try to persuade us of the ability levels that we have. So, for example, if a child's teachers and a child's peers constantly tell him he's stupid at math, or they persuade him to work harder because he's failing, he will likely change his sense of self-efficacy about math skills to match what he's heard. And the fourth source of information that will change our self-efficacy is the emotional state and the physiological pain and pleasure that we feel internally in the context of performing some task. We have feedback from our own experiences. So, for example, if while giving a public talk, a person has really sweaty palms and a racing heart and feels lightheaded and nauseous, the person's likely to develop a lower sense of self-efficacy about his public speaking ability. He says, wow, under those conditions, everything's falling apart. Now, I think you can see that the idea of self-efficacy is a very important one, because it will then influence where we go, the environments we pick, and what challenges we'll take. What we think we can do will become what we can do. There have been several other researchers who have developed theories of motivation that are very similar to Bandura's self-efficacy theory. And whenever I see a convergence of theorizing, a convergence of empirical evidence coming from different people that are more or less working independently, I think, wow, this is a good sign. This tends to strengthen, in my mind and in others, the validity of this conceptualization. There must be something to this idea, because several different independent people are thinking about it and providing some evidence that it's working. So at this time, I think it's really worthwhile to mention some of these other related theories. They were smaller theories. They didn't involve, the entire field of development, but they were important. And one that I thought was extremely important was a theory that Robert White came up with in a classic paper written in 1959. He beat all the others to the punch, including Bandura. He wrote this influential paper that argued that when humans have met their basic needs, such as being fed, having food, having water, having rest, being the right temperature, not being too tired. When they've met these basic needs, they don't simply shut down like machines or like my dog. They don't function like lower animals. I'm going to drive you crazy with my lizards as my comparison. But when a lizard meets its basic needs, it goes to sleep. Goes into a coma almost. Okay. But when humans meet their basic needs, what happens? Think about it. You are not hungry, not thirsty, not too cold, not too hot, well rested, feeling very comfortable. What do? You're ready for action. You want something to happen. And White said, we're very intrinsically motivated in these times to act on our world, to cause things to happen. Now, in humans, at least in our culture, and probably for a good share of human existence, these times are actually quite frequent. Most of the time, we're not in some crisis of meeting the basic needs. And so at these times, these frequent times, when we're doing okay, what do? We seek out challenging tasks. We want stimulation. We want excitement. We want to avoid boredom. Now, when we seek out challenges, ideally we seek out what's called optimal challenges, those challenges that are not too boring, not too easy in a task, and not way above us, out of our range. An optimal challenge is going to push us to the limit if we're going to be successful at this task. There's a chance of failure with an optimal challenge, but there's also a good chance that you can succeed. If you're playing tennis, an optimal challenge is picking out somebody who's about at your level, who it would be tough to beat, but of course you can beat that person once in a while. You don't want to play somebody who's well above your level, and you don't want to play somebody who's a beginner if you're somewhere in between. So you seek out these challenges, and when you're successful at meeting these challenges, you have this strong feeling or sense of efficacy, that you had an effect, that you caused something to happen, that you affected the environment, you accomplished this. And this sense of efficacy feels good. And this is the motivation that makes us want to strive to seek this kind of feeling quite often. In this process, we're more likely to develop mastery and competence in our lives, because we're seeking out the things that will push us to our limits and help us to develop. So you're more likely to develop flexible, different skills because of this motivation. Now, White argued that this mastery or competence motivation, he called it mastery motivation, competence motivation, was highly adaptive. It's because of this that humans remain flexible, that they remain ever-learning, they constantly try new tasks, they constantly try challenging tasks. They don't wait for a task to be absolutely required to do it. So, for example, we seek challenges at times when we're not required to perform something. In children, they do it in play all the time. They play because it can be stimulating and challenging, and they work out a lot of issues and learn a lot through their play. We do challenging tasks when we don't have deadlines, when we aren't being evaluated. Kinds of things that often happen in our jobs don't necessarily push us to be challenged. We engage in hobbies. We do crossword puzzles. We do things just for the fun of it. And these are the times where we'll take chances, where we'll take risks. And thus we become more creative and more flexible. It's our human nature to do so. I have to mention here that White also came from a Freudian background, as many of the other theorists we've talked about. He was a psychoanalyst, and he, like others, became disgruntled with the shortcomings of the Freudian psychoanalytic approach. And in trying to talk about this kind of motivation, why we do these kinds of things, he developed this view of mastery motivation to explain our creative, our playful, and our risk-taking nature. Susan Harder is another theorist who added to White's theory by giving examples of how one's history of successes and failures over time actually change a person's level of motivation to seek challenges or avoid them. White came along and said, we have this. It's built into the human nature. But Harder, like Bandura, tried to talk about how it would change over time. Her view is such that, and she has several examples and research to show this, but basically the view is, over time, if we seek out a very challenging task and we're successful at it, again and again this happens, and also if we're rewarded by others for putting in an effort, for trying to seek challenging tasks, eventually these things cycle back and increase our motivation to seek out mastery. And I would argue our self-efficacy. On the other hand, if most of the time we fail at challenging tasks and we're actually punished for our initiatives, again and again, this will cycle back and decrease our motivation to seek mastery and our self-efficacy. So it's our constant experience, one way, on one side or the other side, that will change this motivation. Martin Seligman was another person who developed a highly influential theory that's also related. His theory was a theory of learned helplessness. A person often learns to become helpless because of continuous experiences with failing at a task and not having the ability to affect a change in one's environment. Do these sound similar? White, Harder, Seligman, and of course Bandura, I think they're related. In this learned helplessness case, in a sense, a person tends to give up if she thinks she's helpless and to have any control. After a series of tasks that you can't solve, you don't try anymore. And in experiments that Seligman did with both dogs and with humans, he found that you could put somebody in a situation, give them a series of tasks that were really, unbeknownst to them, impossible to solve. And after a whole series of these tasks, then you would give this person a task that they in fact could solve, and they wouldn't even try. Another person who had been able to solve those tasks through working at them would try the new task. And so his argument is that in our real life, we become helpless at times. And in fact, this relates in some ways to aging as well. Very often, older people believe they can't do something, and they learn to be helpless because of maybe some failures or some situations, and they quit trying to do the things that they can do, in this theory. Now, a student of Seligman's was Carol Dweck, and Carol Dweck developed a theory that's related to learned helplessness. It's a theory about how we come to believe what our basic skills and abilities are, what the sources are to which we attribute our abilities. And she focused mainly on people's conceptions of their intelligence, but it relates the same way. Dweck showed that when a person primarily has experiences in which she's made to believe that she can change an attribute or ability because of her own efforts, she'll come to believe that this ability isn't a fixed amount. It isn't a particular level. That effort determines the skill level that she can develop. It's not something that you're born with. And in this case, a person's more likely to try harder after failures. Interesting. The effect of failures on somebody who believes that effort makes a difference and you can change an ability is to use those failures for feedback and try harder and to accept challenges, to take risks. Even though you know you might fail, it gives you a chance to develop your skills. On the other hand, Dweck showed that when a person primarily has experiences in which she's been led to believe that an attribute or an ability has some fixed entity, that it's an amount within her, that it's inborn, then she comes to believe she can't change this skill level. And in this case, a person will be more likely to avoid challenging tasks, tasks that might show her to be incompetent, and she'll give up in the face of challenges. And she did research with students in schools and found that this was in fact the case. That if students believed that their intellectual level, for example, was what they were born with, intelligence is what you get at birth, then they didn't want to do tasks that might show them to be stupid. They would do tasks that they knew they could do well at, but they didn't want to let others see how stupid they were. If they believed intelligence isn't some fixed entity, but intelligence is just something you can get better and better at or worse at, depending on how you do, they were more likely to take the challenging task because they wanted to get better at it. Boys, by the way, tend to blame teachers for their problems, and girls tend to blame themselves more in intellectual tasks on this ability, and it seems to be related to the way teachers treat them. In general, at least in the school years, even though boys and girls don't differ in abilities, and even in the grades they get in the early school years, girls are treated as if you're really smart. And if you don't do this right, what's wrong? You should be able to do this. Boys are constantly told, you're lazy. You're just not careful. You're sloppy. And they tend to blame the teachers for criticizing them, and they get this view, I can try harder, and I can make a difference. We need to now go to a review, an evaluation of Bandura's theory. You can see that in this part of it, there are a lot of theories that converge and seem to relate together. Let me now talk about which parts of the theory that Bandura contributed that are really good. And this is from the combined social learning theory and from his self-efficacy theory. As with a lot of these theories, you have to keep in mind what they contributed and what was around before the person came up with a theory and what's around today. Before Bandura, learning theory did not take account of cognitive processes, nor did it account for the great importance of observational learning that we talked about last time. Now, Bandura's theory is still mechanistic. It's grounded in behaviorist traditions of learning theory. But he added that cognitive focus, and he added, as we've seen with the self-efficacy theory, a focus on beliefs and about attributions and expectancies. And Bandura's theory has had a great impact on research in several areas. The development of aggression, we mentioned that. The development of phobias, how children, by observing others, learn when to be afraid and not to be afraid, just by observing others. On the lack of motivation to attempt tasks in older adults, when in fact they could do tasks and come to believe because of their efficacy that they can't. He had a success on ways to deal with various kinds of problem behaviors and disorders. So in an applied sense, his theory has become very successful. It has a great record. Because he grounded the process of development in learning, he tended to equate development with learning. In his theory, it seems that all of development is simply what we've learned. Now, as a criticism, others would argue that because of that approach, he failed to explain some major reorganizations or structure in thinking and skills. He had a tendency to focus on the processes, not the stage-like changes or the structure. And the processes he discussed are worthwhile. He talked about vicarious reinforcement, observational learning, reciprocal determinism, but they function independently of the age of a person. And this approach has the tendency to treat children as miniature adults. They're less experienced, but they function the same way and with the same nature and the same internal processes that can be found in adults. Now, in some ways, this is true. But because of this lack of focus on the unique features of childhood, the way they may change from birth to maturity, a lot of people believe that social learning theory misses important aspects of development, and indeed of human nature. It falsely attributes some adult-like abilities to children that they don't possess at young ages. In Bandura's terms, any process you do, any of these things we've talked about, you could apply just as well to toddlers, school-age kids, adolescents, adults, older people. In some ways, yeah, I'll leave it at that. But as a compensation, I have to say, his theory does deal quite well with adulthood and aging, better than some of the other theories. we can ask again, why would an older person believe that he had little ability to do something? And Bandura's theory will explain it, and Bandura's theory will explain how he can learn from others. In our next lecture, we're going to shift gears. We're going to now talk about the fifth theory in our sequence, and that's Piaget's theory of cognitive development. Thank you.